people want to love nature and they want to commune with nature. And we're just giving that a more direct voice. And as that raises care and raises activity, I think we'll have achieved a net good.
In the future, we're going to be able to walk outside and look to a sugar maple that it's in our yard or a birch tree and walk up to that tree and say, "Birch tree, tell me, how are you feeling today? What's the last month been like? What can I do to help you lead your best birch tree life?" We're going to be able to actually communicate with nature in ways that we can't even imagine today. Except it turns out that future is not exactly as far away as we might think. My name is Lex Kiefaber. Welcome back to another episode of Who's Saving the Planet?
At Sea Change, our goal is bringing together adventurous minds to build relationships and focus on solutions to some of the biggest problems on the planet. This isn't your typical conference and is unlike any event that I know. It's immersive and intimate and strikes a balance between work and play. It's a place where you're encouraged to think and act outside the box and be challenged by new ideas and experiences. The people and points of view in attendance are incredibly diverse, but all share an incredible commonality: a strong drive to learn from new perspectives and ideas. We are more innovative, productive, creative, and capable when we act with the support of other passionate people. That's why Sea Change exists. I highly recommend joining us September 12 through 14, 2023 to take part and experience it for yourself. Hope to see you there.
On the pod today, we have Graham Hine. He is the co-founder and CEO of ePlant. That's ePlant.bio. Graham has worked in the world of robotics and manufacturing for years, and he was the CEO of Liquid Robotics previously before it was acquired by Boeing. And Graham has created something that is absolutely fascinating, which at its core is going to change our relationship with nature in the most personal and fundamental ways by allowing us to actually communicate with the plants that are in our garden. All right. Here's my conversation with Graham Hine, the co-founder and CEO of ePlant.
Graham, welcome to this episode of Who's Saving the Planet. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Lex. Looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, this is going to be a doozy. We said this before. We've got so much to dig into here, but let's start with the plot. And then we'll move into the subtext and the themes and the metaphors and all of that. But let's just start with the plot. Tell me about your company, ePlant. And specifically, let's start with, like, what does it do in the sort of elevator pitch version?
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways to look at what ePlant does. I look at it in terms of our mission. We're trying to keep trees alive. So trees are under assault from a lot of different fronts, as we know. Not only getting cut down by humans, but burned in forest fires. And people struggle to keep their trees alive. New trees don't plant well. They don't necessarily establish. And part of our mission is to keep the trees that we're planting alive, because we've got to do that to address the issue of climate change. It's one of our biggest knobs, is to put trees in the ground and make sure that they grow. To do that, ePlant looks at the vital signs of a tree and tries to present that information back to those responsible for caring for them. And to do that, we wanted to make that as engaging as possible. And to do that, we're trying to use AI to make the trees actually talk to you.
Which we are 100% going to dig into. But let's make sure I understand the groundwork, right? Pun intended. This is a monitor that you place into a specific tree to record various aspects, various sort of data around that tree's ecosystem, that microenvironment for that tree, and then it reports that information back to some sort of centralized receiver so that you have an understanding of the different variables that are affecting the tree and the tree health.
Exactly. So we've got a little device, an inexpensive sensor that sits on the tree, communicates wirelessly back. It's solar powered. It's low maintenance. You don't have to touch it very often because you don't want to be having to deal with that. And it sends information back to the cloud, where AIs analyze the data and then present that information back to the users. Started out with agriculture. So agricultural users looking at taking care of their crops, trying to reduce the amount of water they're using, reduce the amount of chemicals. This information is important for them to optimize their planting operations. That started to segue into forestry. And then as we realized that we could make a very engaging, fun interface for taking care of trees, we started looking hard at the consumer market. And that's where we really got into the talking trees aspect of what we're doing.
What type of data does the sensor record? What's important, I guess, to know about a tree health?
Yeah, so you want to know about the environment the tree's in. And that's just like a micro weather station. So temperature, humidity, and light are kind of the core environmental variables that we're using. We have an accelerometer on there to see if the tree is moving in a way that suggests it might fall down, so typically leaning. So we're looking at tree risk. But the most interesting sensor from my perspective, and really the most biologically rich, is something called a dendrometer. And what that's doing is literally measuring the pulse of the outside skin of the tree. So we mount that to the tree, and there's a little plunger that, you know, think about it like the two fingers on your pulse at your neck. That's literally what it's measuring. And it's measuring down to microscopic scales, to a micron, which is a thousandth of a millimeter. And the signals we're looking for are the daily water cycle of the tree. So as it goes through its daily cycle during the day, the plants, and it's not just trees, but it's plants and trees and vines, but the plant will evaporate water through its leaves and will open up pores in its leaves to evaporate water as it's hot and dry and there's light for it to photosynthesize. That shrinks the size of the tree and it shrinks it by about half the width of a human hair. During the nighttime, that all relaxes. So now the tree is drawing water from the ground. The pores are closed. It's cooler. It's humid. So there isn't as much evaporation happening from the tree. And the tree swells back up again. And of course, it grows over time. So we see a growth signal as well as this daily heartbeat. And that daily heartbeat is a data-rich signal. So it's, you know, if you put water on the tree midday, you can see that change in the rate of water absorption in the roots and water availability. If you've got disease, you can see metabolic damage affect the growth of the tree. And we're using analytics and machine learning and other tools to try to understand that signal. And part of that's a big data challenge. We want to have a lot of trees to compare to. So we use the data from all of the trees to compare to all of the other trees to look for what's normal and then identify what's abnormal. And that's what we're flagging for folks. So abnormal would be drought, disease, lean, or other types of signals, which suggest the tree might be in distress.
I think that you bring up a good point where you had to build some technology to make this possible. Right? This wasn't something that was sort of an amalgamation of off-the-shelf parts. So this dendrometer, is there a set of data for you to pull from that sort of you can normalize and say, here, this is what a normal tree looks like based on this very specific data? Or are you guys really building this data set in real time of being able to capture this information in sort of this for the first time, for like at a large scale?
Yeah, we're not the first guys to figure out that you can measure the signal. So I wouldn't say, you know, we did not invent the dendrometer. There are scientific papers on it. People have done this using essentially lab-grade equipment where they put a LVDT, which is a precision measurement device on the surface of a tree, connected up to a data logger and a battery and a radio and a solar panel. So there's papers that kind of describe what this signal is expected to do for a tree or a small number of trees. What's changing here is we've made that device kind of one unit. So we're put the solar panel, put the battery, put the radios, put the sensors, put the environmental sensors all in one unit and make it inexpensive enough that you can deploy a lot of them.
So would this be like a poor analogy of sort of, you know, computers used to be large and fit into rooms and now you've created something like the microchip that allows us to make these, to proliferate this technology?
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to kind of overuse analogy here, but it's kind of like going from a desktop computer with a separate monitor, keyboard, power supply, and a CPU and putting it into an iPhone.
There was a lot that you said there to unpack. I guess let's go to the heart of it. Again, so many puns, but pun intended, the heartbeat. Like you are listening to this sort of EKG for these trees in a way where you're able to do it at a much broader scale. What have you learned
from the trees?
So I am not a biologist, but I've been tangentially involved with biologists for the last 20 years in one way or another. And one thing I've learned is that these trees are extremely responsive to their environment. So in a lot of ways, our device is not the sensor. The sensor is, in fact, the tree. And what the tree is sensing is the climate and its environment and how it's responding. It's the canary in the coal mine. It's telling us what's happening around it. And people ask me all the time, do we need to stick one of these on every tree? And the answer is absolutely not. I mean, my sales team would say, yes, please, but no. You can put one of these in your yard and get a sense as to how your whole yard is doing. And in turn, that gives you an idea as to what the neighborhood is doing and how the neighborhood is changing. The neighborhood flora is changing over time in response to our changing environment. And it's an accumulation effect. The head of tree care for the city of Carmel told me once that large trees like these coast live oaks and the typical California trees, they experience drought in one year, and it doesn't kill them that year. It kills them 3 years later as they're weakened by the drought, and then they're susceptible to various diseases and other pathogens which can affect them, and they die 3 years later. So watching what's happening in real time and responding to it lets you head that off up to 3 years in advance of really having a problem with your tree. And that kind of early warning system is not something we envisioned when we first put this together, but it does seem to be what we're getting out of the system. And it's one of the reasons why I want to collectivize the data and kind of we're looking at our customers as participants in a grand experiment to understand what's happening with the trees and vines and flora around us. How do we get these sensors broadly deployed? How do we understand what's really happening and how does that affect us and our planet?
Mm-hmm. When you say your customers, I'm trying to think about the use case for this, right? And on one hand, there's like the curiosity aspect, right? If I'm an individual, then we'll talk about how you anthropomorphize the tree. But who do you envision to be the people that can get the most out of this, whether that's a government entity, whether that's large nurseries, whether that's scientific entities, like, or individual consumers? And I'm sure that everyone can get a use case out of it, but where do you see this really having the most impact?
I think it's mobilizing individuals, homeowners, and tree owners to understand their trees better. So all of us, if you own a home and you own a tree, you probably care about that tree, but you may not think about it very much. But that tree is actually an incredibly valuable asset to you and your community. And the use case for you as an individual tree owner is to try to keep that tree alive and maintain that investment and use it as a starting off point to understand what's happening with trees all around us, not just in my front yard. So if I were a tree owner and just purely looked at it as a financial issue, I can put a $80 sensor on my tree and I can watch whether or not that tree needs water. And I can see if that tree is starting to lean over and causing a risk for my house and could fall on my house. I'm avoiding these ROIs. And there's kind of an actuarial assessment that says it makes sense to monitor and board trees around your house. It's just it's a good value proposition. The numbers line up. The risks of trees falling is high and it's growing. Trees are harder to keep alive. People are changing their landscaping to low watering landscapes. Well, they don't necessarily think that tree that's been around for 30 years expects the lawn to get watered and was growing off the water that lawn provided. So you remove that lawn, you go to xeriscaping. You're reducing your water use, but you're also ignoring the fact that tree that provides you shade, cooling, and environment and property value is going to die. So there's a straightforward kind of financial incentive to do this for a tree. Then there's the larger scale, or sort of the more soft aspects of this. There's an opportunity to kind of get to know the tree and understand what its needs are and grow your understanding of it as an entity. And humans anthropomorphize things. They think of things in their own terms and how they can make them relatable. So if the tree can sort of, if we can sort of play into that and yet add the complexity of the real biology of a tree, we can create a conversation with a new class of entity that people are starting to interact with, relate to, think about, care about, and then act on.
Okay, I guess we have to do it then. I've delayed us as long as I can. Let's get into it. You have given these trees a voice. You have connected two burgeoning technologies, your sensor and your ability to capture this data in real time, and large language models that are able to take these types of data sets and create what appears to be conversational tiles. And you have named your first tree Barkley because, of course, you are not without a dad-sized sense of pun.
Oh, yeah. I like my dad puns.
Yeah. So let's talk with Barkley.
Yeah. So Barkley is my grumpy coastline oak. And Barkley wakes up and says, good day to you, friend. Let's just say that today has not been one of my better days.
This is real time now. Like, we're actually going to have a conversation with Barkley.
Yeah. So I'll have to read for Barkley because right now this is text only.
Okay. Well, I'll ask Barkley a question then.
Okay.
Barkley, what was yesterday like for you?
Yesterday was fairly typical for me, nothing out of the ordinary. The temperature was mild and the humidity was moderate. The only issue was a slight lean caused by the wind, but that's just par for the course.
Par for the course. So Barkley's...
Barkley likes his tree puns too.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Got it, Barkley. What can I do to make your situation a little bit better?
Well, I could use a good watering if you have the time. Been a bit thirsty lately, as my point dendrometer reading suggests that my tree water deficit is elevated. If you could spare a little water for me, I would greatly appreciate it. Additionally, if you see any dead or damaged limbs, it would be helpful for you to remove them. Finally, if you know of any tree-friendly fertilizers, I wouldn't mind a little pick-me-up.
How about your friends around you, Barkley? What have the other trees been saying to you recently?
I'm not one to gossip, but I have noticed that some of the other trees in the neighborhood have been complaining about the lack of rain recently. They've all been feeling a little parched lately. We could really use some precipitation to help us out. The coast live oaks nearby have been talking about pests and diseases that have affected them, but fortunately, I've not been affected by those yet.
Okay, now how would Barkley know that the other trees around them have been affected by this particular disease?
So this is a community data set. And we remove precise GPS information for analysis, but we do keep regional information about where the trees are. So the trees actually do have the ability to look at the data set and determine what's happening in the neighborhood around them. And we feed that back as insights to the large language model and give it some context about what's happening with other trees. So one of my other trees, Scarlet, knows that she's the fastest growing red maple around. And she's kind of smug about it.
Let's just start with why, right? Like, this is unnecessary to achieve the core goal, right? The core goal of saying tree health, right? It's just let's take this data and let's do the things with it. And so I can't imagine that it was simple to make this leap to apply this type of technology to create this interface where not only can I talk with the tree, but the tree feels as though you've given the tree humanish qualities. Right, you've given the tree a sense of humor. You've given the tree a sense of community. To affect me somehow, and my question is, why have you done this?
So, we started with agriculture and forestry and research. Those are all great use cases for this technology. In agriculture, by measuring water stress on a tree or plant, you can reduce the amount of water you use. In forestry, you can keep an eye on how the forest is evolving, changing climate. And in research, plant breeders are studying how to make plants survive better in increasing drought conditions. And so understanding the tree's response to watering is critical for their research. As we looked at the data that we're getting back and kind of how do we present this in a useful way to an individual tree owner, it was actually a fairly complex data visualization problem. And I think we've addressed it to some degree. You know, we can give you a bit of a traffic light on on how stressed your tree is or how much water it needs. So you could present this information in a useful way. But there's really an engagement issue with getting people to take care of things. We wanted to make it fun enough, and we wanted to play into the fact that people will take care of things like a Tamagotchi. People will take care of a pet rock. People will take care of something they anthropomorphize. And ultimately, it was a motivation question. How do we motivate the people to actually take action and take care of this thing? And by giving it a bit of a personality and giving it, you know, raising it from, you know, your favorite shoe to, you know, a little closer to your pet in your hierarchy of care, we thought we would be better able to get people to act. We got another benefit here, which the large language models brought along with them. And that is that they have been trained on horticultural information. So they know what mulch is. They know what fertilizer is. They know what a tree care regime should look like. And we steer that. We direct it to say, this is a coastal live oak. It's in this climate zone. It's got these, you know, it's this old. It has these issues. I mean, it irrigated at this time. But the large language models are able to take that and then provide care recommendations that are actually pretty insightful. And, you know, large language models, you know, will likely release this feature as a beta because the large language models are still a little bit inclined to hallucinate. But it does provide that personification that raises care, and it provides horticultural planting guidance that's tree specific that actually otherwise would be very hard for us to produce.
You know, it feels like you have built a very elaborate Trojan horse where on the outside, this looks like a tactical solution to tree health, but inside is hidden an empathy machine where you're teaching me to care in a way I didn't expect to empathize with something that feels inanimate.
There's a bit of that aspect, but I think the way I think of it is that people actually like to have something to care about. They like to have that feeling. And you ask a lot of folks who have a favorite tree, and these are kind of our first customers are folks who really care about the environment, their trees and their surroundings, and they're looking for a way to engage. And so in a way, we're feeding into something that's already there, or where people want to love nature and they want to commune with nature. And we're just giving that a more direct voice. And as that raises care and raises activity, I think we'll have achieved that good.
Let's do this. Let's ask Barkley another question. You've been talking to Barkley for a long time, right? Does Barkley have a memory? Does this tree remember your conversations from how far back? Do you tokenize it or?
You're actually asking about a roadmap feature, which is remember the last conversation. And we don't have that implemented yet.
Okay.
So it remembers what we just said, but it won't remember beyond this session.
Okay. So it doesn't. Okay. Let's ask Barkley this. Barkley, I've read news about fires in your area, and that's made me scared for you. How do you feel about the fires?
As a tree, I don't really have emotions in the same way that humans do, but I am certainly aware of the danger that fires pose to me in the surrounding area. Coastal live oaks like myself are particularly susceptible to damage from fires, and many have been lost in wildfires in the past. It's important to take precautions to prevent fires from starting, such as making sure that campfires are properly extinguished and clearing away dry brush from around homes.
Okay. So do you guys build guardrails into this yourself, or are you sort of cribbing off of the large language models to build those guardrails in?
We certainly lean heavily on the large language models for guardrails, but we do have guardrails of our own around keeping the tree focused on the conversation versus wandering off on dead ends. So we do.
Yeah. You don't want to get it into loops. You don't want to go. Right.
Yeah. We don't want it, you know, suddenly pretending it's a rabbit. Right. So we work on those kind of guardrails.
So I want to then now let's extrapolate. right? This is day zero of this. You are taking this product right now and you are launching it into the world. What does it look like when, let's say 5 years from now, you have this, whatever the equivalent of a neural network is of trees, linked up into the cloud with reporting all of this data back and then infusing this ever expanding and improving AI technology to not only make sense of that data, but to contextualize it within the larger scope of information? Where do you see this going?
So, two areas of progress that I think are going to result as we expand the scope of the system. One is we're at the beginnings of understanding these biological signals we're getting back from trees. So the dendrometer signals, I would say, our understanding is good. We're building on the shoulders of work that's been done in the past and adding our own. But they are complex biological signals that we need to understand individually. And we need to understand growth and health of our forests collectively. So I would say that there's a research output from the data set we're going to be creating that will essentially be a deeper understanding of the biological signals of these plants and how they respond to the environment, and a collectivized understanding of overall health and climate impact on flora that's kind of a useful scientific output. And that scales. The more data we have, the better those results are going to be. Meanwhile, the large language models are going to learn from those insights and learn from the conversations that are being had and be better able to present the information in useful and engaging ways. What I don't expect to happen is that those AIs will engage with the information themselves and start creating new data products. I think that's research that's done by the analytics, not by the large language model.
What if you framed it before as very much an interaction with the tree, you know, the human side of this, right? This is a dyad and it takes both in order for it to be effective. So also at scale, you're going to have hundreds of thousands or millions of people developing relationships with anthropomorphized trees. Like, that goes back to the why, right? Is that part of the mission, or does that feed into what you believe is important for ePlant?
The relationships that they have with trees are a means to get them to care about the environment and to give them knowledge that makes them better able to respond to what we need to do to change the climate. So if we can interest, say, 5% of the people who are engaging with these trees in actively participating in reforestation or preserving wildlands or simply caring for the urban trees among us, I think we'll have achieved our mission of caring for trees and helping them grow. And that is, I think, more achievable by building those relationships with trees.
So you obviously have an agenda, and it is a laudable or altruistic agenda. And so many very compelling science fiction apocalypse stories start with a really nifty invention and a laudable, like, aspirational agenda. And when you're talking about LLMs and AI in general, there's this problem of alignment. Of aligning the idea of what is the human outcome and how does the machine perceive its goals and its sub-goals. The most obvious, the most thrown one was the paperclip example, where you say, you tell a machine, I want to create as many paperclips as possible. And then it goes through the process of building a paperclip creating machine, and it realizes that in order for it to build the most paperclips possible, it needs to take as much mass as it can and turn into paperclips. And humans constitute a lot of mass. It can get in the way. So it ends up building machines that turn humans into paperclips in order to make those paperclips. What you're doing is so much more interesting, because we are at a pivotal time in the history of human civilization where humans have had this relationship with nature that's been extractive. and it's precipitated all of these, this issue of climate change that we're dealing with right now. So on one hand, if you were to take the trees writ large and to give them that spark of life, let's say, and a voice with which to do it, it would be opposed to much of the way that humans have conducted ourselves on this earth. Like, we have not figured out how to align our objectives. I'm trying to get to a question here, but I kind of just want to like throw that back to you. Like, this is, you live in this world. What say you?
Well, I'm a giant sci-fi nerd, so I'm right there with you. And I've read all of those, you know, be careful of machine intelligence because it can take over and cause, you know, all kinds of catastrophic end scenarios. And what's interesting is that I think these conversations are really important. And there are really critical ethical issues with how humanity uses these burgeoning large language models, which look so human. And these control systems, which are run through artificial intelligence, everything from robotic manipulation to planning to routing and other sorts of challenging problems to solve. And you connect those together and you start to say, well, where can this scenario take us? Let's say we give all these trees a voice in their own care. And then let's say we take that to the next logical step. All right, the trees are now responsible for their own care. We're going to go beyond just, you know, having a cute conversation with them. The trees are now going to
turn on tree autopilot, right? I say, I'm going to turn on my tree autopilot and I'll connect it to my water system.
And you know, that's actually a totally reasonable roadmap feature for ePlanet, right? I want to have the tree control its water. So let's say you take that to the next thing and now I can order fertilizer from Amazon. Then it realizes it can order other things from Amazon and new products start to get built and shot. And, you know, You can paint a scenario where the tree intelligence gets enough agency to go hog wild and cause a problem. I think we're technically kind of a long way from that. You know, right now we kind of have a cute conversation, and I'd love to turn on automatic tree watering because I'd use it at home. We're a little far away from just that. I don't think these are hard scenarios to guard against technically. You know, honestly, I was asked the question, have you consulted with an AI ethicist as you develop this product? And, you know, some of these more challenging questions that you get around AI. And I think, you know, as I said earlier, there are really important ethical issues with AI. I am not sure making trees more engaging gets us to the ethical issues. And I hadn't really created a scenario in my head. Again, I'm a bit of a, you know, sci-fi nerd, so I like to play out these scenarios. I haven't come to one that I think is really plausible for where this goes that leads us into trouble. Now, you know, that could be the optimism of youth. Not that I'm a youth, but, you know, we're certainly young in our understanding of what these large language models are capable of.
Well, I guess on one hand, you're saying that the whole purpose of this is self-preservation for the tree. And on the other hand, you're saying, well, that self-preservation is going to have guardrails. It's going to have limits. And we're going to make sure that it's boxed in without the ability to exceed those limits. And that's kind of the idea of AI in general, right? We're going to say this is a tool for humans. And we're going to assume that that tool is going to be useful for us up until a point. And we're going to assume, usually what we're worried about is bad actors, right? People exploit, other humans exploiting this and taking the guardrails off, what have you. What I find so compelling about this is that there's so much about nature that we kind of understand, but we don't fully understand the way that natural environments and ecosystems really work and coalesce. We're always learning about this. And if you were to say, well, let's take out the bad actors on this from the humans that we can, we kind of get humans to some extent and we say, well, what would the trees want if their objective was self-preservation? You are creating, you're breaking down the language barrier here to some degree about that. And I understand it's very tactical at this sense, but in theory, that is the next logical question of like, if the trees are designed to look out for what's best for the trees, are humans useful in that scenario?
Well, so at the end of the day, this is about giving the trees some agency, right? The ability to act and not just talk. And so what agency would you give a tree? So in my example earlier, water yourself. So the tree can start to turn on and off sprinklers, or the tree gets into a mode where it can, you know, provide fertilizer or fertigation or other sorts of activities, or it can summon somebody to come and prune it. But, you know, trees, I don't know if you're a Tolkien fan, but trees aren't X. They can't actually defend themselves. So a tree's best defense is to actually mobilize humans to take care of it. And, you know, I don't know that it ends there. I can't imagine, and again, this is maybe just a failure of imagination on my part, but giving the trees enough agency to act in a way that is contrary to human best interest is not a path I fully understand. I don't follow how those steps fit together.
But it's, I got to say, it's a fascinating thing, right? This is though it's real life right now, or in 5 years, the world will look very different, right? And we'll look back to this moment and say, here's the moment that Graham made trees talk. And like, there are many branching realities that will precipitate from this moment. And we certainly do not know what they will portend, but like, here we are, we are in that moment.
We are. And where it gets interesting is, you know, in factories, let's say you fully AI automate a factory. And factory automation has been a big thing for decades, right? Everybody's trying to get the machines to operate efficiently in a factory. Well, a factory actually has a lot of agency. It's got a lot of control systems. It's taking in raw materials and producing finished goods in the back. I would be concerned about giving a factory full agency to operate. I think in our current environment, we are symbiotic with trees. You know, humans are the problem, but we are also symbiotic. And it's super interesting to think about how would trees make humans a symbiote if they had full agency? Would they remove humans, or would they turn humans into tree care agents and systems?
I'm not sure we do very well on either one of those scenarios as humans.
Yeah, there's probably a horizon where it's great and you get more oxygen-rich atmosphere for taking care of more trees, but...
Well, there's the other part about this that I'm also... If we're thinking about trees sort of as a monolithic entity, that's one thing, but what we've learned about trees is that they have means of communicating as, you know, as communities, as species, as warning other trees of things that are coming along, whether that's predators from pests or disease or what have you, that we had no idea existed. And we certainly don't understand fully, right? We're scratching the surface of understanding that these things exist and that they are happening. But we do not I spoke with somebody who was a neuroscientist, and so his idea was rewiring the brain, and he would do things like you don't know how to walk for something in your brain. So what they would do is they would help you rewire it by creating a virtual simulation of you walking and sort of like retraining your brain to understand how to walk. And he was like, I know this works and I kind of understand how it works, but I don't really get what the brain is doing on the inside to realign those neural pathways. And he moved into being an agriculturalist. And so he then worked as somebody who was creating a better environment for plants to grow. And he was like, I know there's lots of inputs in this environment when you're thinking about all of the things that go into an ecosystem. And I kind of get if I take one out or if I change one here or there, it has different effects. But there's no way I can really understand what the whole magnitude of these different impulses are doing to affect one another. That's what is also very compelling about this, is that you are building technology into these large systems that we like kind of understand but don't fully understand. and then allowing those individual actors to communicate with one another through this technology in the cloud. Like, that really is the bedrock foundation of, let's just throw our hat into the unknown, like knowing that it's unknown, and see what happens.
There's definitely a brave new world aspect here, where our big data systems, our sensing capabilities, and our analytical tools, our automated analytical tools like these large language models, generative AI, and simply analytical machine learning tools are kind of coming together. And, you know, then you remind me, our chairman, Joe Rizzi, kind of started on this path towards ePlant 30, 35 years ago. His doctor buddy from Good Samaritan gifted him with a used EEG. And he started, you know, as soon as he annoyed all of his friends by sticking it on them and looking at the signals, he had to find some other subject. He started to put them on plants. And these are, you know, measuring microvoltages in the tissues of organisms, right? He put them on plants, got on a paper roll, a little squiggly line, took it into the team at Good Samaritan and said, hey, you know, what does this signal look like? And they said, hey, this looks a lot like a four-year-old boy, but he might have some, you know, neurological issues going on. And so the realization from that is that these plants actually have biological signaling, kind of every bit as complex as humans, just different. And that started the journey to understand those signals. And Jupiter, which is, you know, essentially ePlant's founding organization, did research where they were literally putting plants in a Faraday cage, sealed, environmentally sealed, and try to understand if those plants could signal each other. And they found some really interesting pathways, everything from acoustic to soil-based channels to electromagnetic signaling that was happening in those plants. So if you prune a leaf off of one plant in one box, the other plant would respond. That led to building some instruments to understanding these plants, which led to building some of the early dendrometers we were using to look at plant growth and the plant's metabolic cycle. And that combined with the realization that we could actually measure some useful vital signals with a low-cost sensor and start to put all those pieces together was kind of the end of a 30-year journey to create ePlant. But ePlant's at the very beginning edge of that. I mean, we are sensing a physical pulse. We will start sensing electrophysical modes as we progress and start to understand those electrophysiological signals. There's mycorrhizal communication pathways we can start to look at. And we're going to learn as part of this journey a lot about the biology. But just as your friend studying neurology is, you know, and that's in a lot of ways a much more sophisticated field of study. Just as he says, look, we understand a lot, but we're so far from understanding the whole. That's true of these plant signals. And it's true of the individual plant signals as well as the collectivized plant signals. There's a lot to learn here. And we're just at the beginning.
Right. I feel like we're using technology to better understand what the plant is telling us. And what if the plant is using technology
or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we always think about it, artificial general intelligence, there needs to be some sort of singularity moment or event or step function. People argue about how far away that is and whether or not it will precipitate the end of humanity or not. But I think it's just such an elegant, such a beautifully poetic eventuality. If the missing piece wasn't us humans putting ourselves in it, but drawing on the much older, much wiser, and much more complex natural world to awaken this idea of AGI.
I think that's absolutely where this is headed collectively. And there's another, you know, you've got me thinking about something that just kind of maybe a little tangential, but I think it adds.
We're in the deep end now. So like, please, yeah. Tangential's fair game.
I'm going to run down this alleyway. So the plants and animals around us have evolved to adapt to humans. And, you know, think about an apple tree. So the, you know, Fuji apple that you like to get from Safeway is, and it is evolved or bred to serve humans. The tree didn't just evolve that way by itself. It's actually, you know, bred by humans. And it arguably is a very successful species because it's adapted to humans. We've seen the same with domestic and livestock animals. You know, some of the most successful animal species in the world are livestock, dogs and cats that have evolved to be symbiotic with humans. And we're likely to see that continue and maybe accelerate as our tools for interacting with these species improve. And I think, you know, the sort of dystopian imagination of a world where these species take over, you know, Rise of the Chickens, is kind of a fun tangent, but I think we're much more likely to see a much more symbiotic future where we are actually working in tandem with plants and animals around us. And we evolve to work with them and they evolve to work with us. And these tools like generative AI, which anthropomorphize and connect us to the data, will make that a more realizable future. And maybe it's certainly a different world, but I would argue a better one, but I don't know that everybody would argue that way. And there's certainly something to look forward to there.
I love that optimism. There's always, you're always an optimist and a cynic when you're working in climate, right? And depends on the day.
And if you're do a startup, you're kind of a lunatic optimist. So that's probably
exactly
wise.
Right. Yeah, you and me both. The idea of symbiosis was something like, you know, animals cultivated for consumption. Forgive the pun, a little hard to stomach, right? We have modified them to be good for us. I'm not sure that relationship is a symbiotic one for the creatures that we are cultivating.
No, you have to take a really mercenary view of genetic success, right? And that's a pretty tough ethical pill to swallow. And yet, I think are arguably evolution in action.
I feel like you're just giving evolution, you know, you're giving it a little bit of like a boost here. A little upgrade. You're creating cyborg trees, and like.
Well, I think our Elon Musk say that, you know, we're all cyborgs now. We have the world's library sitting on our hip with our phones connected to the largest data set in the known history of mankind.
So let me ask you this writ large: like, you seem like you're optimistic about the future.
I think I am.
What are you most afraid of?
Honestly. Other than politics, which is maybe where I sort of fear the most, is I think where we can literally shoot ourselves in the foot, or maybe nearly literally shoot ourselves in the foot is stepping too far into the Luddite practices of denying where this technology is going, and B, allowing a unconstrained and unregulated environment to grow around us. So there's a reasonable fear of new technology. Tools need to be regulated and they need to be controlled and they need to be directed because there are bad actors out there. And what I worry about is that the bad actors outpace the good, and we start to see them take control of these tools, step us into a, you know, dystopian future.
Those fears seem more centered on the AI side of things than on the natural world side of things.
The natural world, well, yeah, I mean, maybe fear number two, you know, this climate journey we're on is headed in the wrong direction, and it's accelerating in the wrong direction. And, you know, my prior job prior to ePlant was working in an ocean science company, Liquid Robotics. We had an ocean-going sensor platform. So I've gone from sensors in the ocean to sensors in the forest.
You've always been known as a sensitive guy, Graham.
Yeah, and then my wife would argue, but there we go. The extent to which things are changing is terrifying and unconstrained right now. And I think the failure to mobilize people to really make substantive change will have real consequences for billions of people going forward. And pushing against that failure, trying to head it off, is, I think, all of our responsibility. So I am very concerned that we are continuing to walk towards the edge of a cliff and that there will be no coming back.
I mean, that everything you just said there speaks to me of the convergence of a incentive empowered nature. And if, like, you know, you were going to take a tree and say, here, have sentience, and they would say, here's two things that we know for sure. Humans are very terrible at knowing how to do the right thing for themselves as a people. And they're very irresponsible with technology. And they always have been. Like, here are two things that we know for sure. And, like, if you were to then reach a logical conclusion as a natural world, like, wow, the best thing for me to do for both the natural world and the humans is to assert a degree of control, because they seem to be careening off the edge.
Yeah, you have to wonder if there is a forest spirit for the world, and if we give life to that forest spirit of the world, what would its decision-making look like around humans? And it would definitely not be status quo.
No, and I'm sure there's people who would champion that, and there's people that would fight against it. But it's a fascinating moment that we're in right now, and you're really developing something which is going to, I mean, I don't know Pandora's box or what have you, if it's something at that level, but it certainly is like a Pandora's curiosity cabinet. I can't wait to see what comes out of this as it proliferates.
Well, me too. And you know, I've got kind of a prosaic view of the, you know, mid to short term here, where simply people will just start taking better care of their trees and keeping more trees alive, which is something we just need to do. But then there's kind of a deep future for the anthropomorphization and more directly giving intelligence and agency to new entities in our midst. And if these really are new entities, if these large language models start to instantiate as real, self-motivated, self-actualized agents in our world, we are definitely seeing a sea change in terms of humanity's role in the world. And humans are tool users. We're going to be inclined to use them for our short-term advantage. And if we're not careful in how our application and we give them agency where we don't want, this is going to be a problem. But we got to give that agency for it. It's not like a machine intelligence is going to be able to just seize it. Someone had to give it the keys. And we've got to be careful about what keys we hand out.
Yeah, you know, I think on that, you know, macro level, conflict of ideas, nature's probably much better suited as an adversary for some sort of artificial intelligence than humans are. And so I guess we'll be either like on the sidelines would be the best place for humans to be. We'll probably be somewhere a little bit less comfortable, but it'll be interesting to see that play out. Well, Graham, I really appreciate your time today. It's given me, and I'm sure everyone listening to that, a ton to think about. We'll make sure that we have all the information in the show notes about where to find the e-plant. When is it coming to market? Just so we know, like, what's the timeline?
Well, folks can pre-order the consumer version now. So just go to our website, eplant.com. We've got a bit of an incentive for our founders, and we're calling them founders because it really is about building this tree data set. And we want early customers who can help us, you know, build our first large scale insights on trees. And that's kind of a citizen science call to action here. We're planning on shipping these in November. They're already shipping out to our commercial customers. So our industrial customers have these and love them. And our team is working like crazy to get the guardrails installed on the AI and get it out into folks' hands.
Well, again, I really appreciate the time and stay in touch. I can't wait. Like, you know, 6 months after this launches, I'd love to catch up and say, like, what have you learned? What are the trees saying? What are they talking to us?
Yeah, I'd love to see if I had any idea where we're really going with this.
Tell me where to build the bunker, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, or all right, Graham. Forest. Thanks, Lex.
Thank you.
All right, that was my conversation with Graham Hine, the founder and CEO of ePlant. Thank you again for listening to this episode of Who's Saving the Planet. Tune in next week for another story of somebody working to salvage our future. And in the meantime, take a moment, write a review for us on Apple Podcasts, tell a friend about it, give us an upvote anywhere you can. We really appreciate it. Okay, we'll see you next week. Cheers.